It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Tensions between the U.S. and Iran are ratcheting up after an attack on two oil tankers near the Persian Gulf. Coming up, we'll find out what happened and what the two sides are saying about the incident. First, it's summertime, which means grills are firing up across Wisconsin. While burgers, brats, and beers are often the usual suspects for the summer cookout, some people get more creative. On this edition of Food Friday, we'll find out how pizzas can shake up your next grilling get-together. Patrick DePula is a chef and owner of Salvatore's Tomato Pies in Madison. Patrick, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio today.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right, grilling pizza, what kind of difference does that make for the flavor?
It's nice to get some of that char in there, so you get really, depending on, I mean, you could grill it on a gas grill, you can grill it on a charcoal grill, a wood grill, it doesn't matter. But if you're grilling it with wood or charcoal, you're going to get a little bit of that wood-fired flavor that you would get from like a Neapolitan pizza oven, but without spending several thousand dollars in your backyard.
So. Yeah, it's a good halfway step to getting that full-on home wood-fired oven.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would worry, I've never done this, I'll get that right up front there. I would worry, okay, I make the pizza dough or I buy the pre-made dough. Is it going to stick to my grill? Am I just going to be trying to scrape it off for the next year?
Well, there's a couple ways to do it. One of the ways that the way that I prefer to do it at home is, and actually it's kind of how I kind of prototyped a bunch of the recipes when we first opened the restaurant. I went to Wisconsin Brick and Fireplace, or one of those places, like a home improvement store, and got fire brick and put fire brick on my grill, kind of like a pizza stone. So then I could heat up that stone. When you put the lid on, it's basically kind of recreating what it would be like to be in that wood-burning pizza oven. So to me, it's a super cheap way to do that, and you're getting really good performance because that brick heats up and retains the heat. So the it's like a hearth-baked pizza on your grill.
You know? Wow.
So regular pizza stone, too, that you can get at the store works, like any one of the
That's stores. Safe to do on a grill, mm-hmm. just like I would in the oven?
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay.
And you could do it directly on the grill, too, but you want to oil the grate really well and then before putting the pizza dough on there.
And just talk us through the basic steps. Do we have to pre-cook the crust itself before toppings go on? What's our order of battle here?
So if you're using the pizza stone method, you don't really have to do anything. You don't have to pre-make anything. You just heat up that stone, make sure that stone's good and hot, and then you could just go from there. You just put the pizza on there, put the lid on, and it's going to bake in, you know, a minute. Probably a minute, minute and a half. So it's really quick. If you're grilling directly on the grate, you want to – what I've always done is I'll oil the grates, oil the dough a little bit too, make sure that I put that down on the grill and kind of get it at least one side done till it's almost done. Then flip it, top it, and let it finish. So I'm topping the side that was down first, so it's already hot. So it's kind of – it just makes the whole process a little more efficient.
Now, let's lay out our grill here a little bit. First of all, if we're just doing a gas grill, what kind of temperatures are we setting it at for
maximum.
Pizza?
Maximum.
Max. High
yep.
heat.
Okay. Yep. I'm a full advocate of just maximum heat when it comes to pizza on the grill.
Okay. Hot, but not cooking it as long, I'm assuming.
Correct. Like, the idea is you get that char and you're going to get it done. And, you know, on a charcoal grill, it might be a good idea to have a section of the grill not as hot as the rest of it. So you can get that initial char and then move it over so the toppings can melt on the top. Same thing with the gas grill. If you have like three burners on your gas grill, turn one down low, have the others on high, and then you can always move that pizza over a little bit so it can finish cooking without burning.
What kind of size pizza do you usually work with on a grill?
10 inches or so. You
okay.
know, 8 to 10 inches. That seems to be ideal because, you know, you can make them quickly and they cook quickly.
And then, yeah, if you have it too big, then it doesn't matter if you have a hot zone, or it's bad if you have a hot zone and a cold zone if the pizza's overlapping both at the same time, I imagine.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you've shared a recipe with us for a roasted beet pesto grilled pizza. Talk
yes.
about this combination of flavors for us.
So I think the first time we ever made that pizza was we did an event on one of the farms that we do business with, and it was for some particular fundraiser. I can't remember which. It's years ago now. And they wanted me to grill pizzas. And at that time, I had never really grilled pizzas before, and I'm going to have to grill pizzas for like 120 people. So how am I going to do this? So basically, I just brought some Weber grill lids, big charcoal, and you know what? I'm going off subject here.
You
asked me about that pizza, so
no,
anyway.
I want to hear the story.
So
forget the pizza for a minute. Tell the story.
You know, I'm thinking about all these vegetables that I want to use that are available from their farm, like right now, and the beets look particularly beautiful. So I'm like, oh, let's make the sauce roasted beet pesto. So I made that roasted beet pesto. They had a bunch of kale and chard, and I ended up charring the kale and chard. and had some goat cheese, and that pizza just turned out really awesome with a little bit of balsamic vinegar on it. So we're still using that pizza till this day, and that's our vegetarian pizza at Johnson Street and in Sun Prairie.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about dough. You recommended with this recipe just getting a store-bought pizza dough.
Yeah, you can go to like any number of places and get pre-made pizza dough. You know, obviously your local pizza place is probably the best source because a lot of pizza places will sell you a dough ball.
I didn't know that.
Yep. You go in and ask, and most will do that. I used to do that before, well, a long time ago, but when I wanted to make pizza quick at home and didn't want to mess around with dough for too long. So, but you can start with pre-made dough. You can make dough yourself. There's a bunch of recipes out there, but one that I find that works pretty well for the grill, and you can Google it. It's like something by Peter Reinhardt, well-known baker, and it's his New York style pizza dough recipe is out there on the internet, and that's a good one to use.
Talking to Patrick DePula, chef and owner of Salvatore's Tomato Pies in Madison. He's helping us make pizzas in general and in particular on the grill. Patrick, even with a good recipe, are there ways, if we're making our own dough now, are there common pratfalls where we go wrong with our pizza dough making?
Yes. The best advice that I can give anyone making pizza dough at home, and this is basically on a question that I always get, is how come my pizza dough is not as good as yours? I'm like, well, when did you make the dough and when did you use it? And usually the response is, well, I made it at 3:00 and I was using it at 4:30. So really, to get the best effect on your pizza dough, to get the best possible flavors, make it ahead, make it a day ahead, and let it proof in the refrigerator overnight and kind of get a cold fermentation going, and it'll be a much different piece of dough to work with the next day. It'll be much better.
Now, I've heard rumors. You mentioned New York-style pizza. I've heard the claim that there's something about New York City municipal water that makes pizza and bagels, for that matter, really good. Do you think there's anything to that?
I love that subject. You want to know why? Because it's absolutely false. I grew up in New Jersey, right? And I can make pizza just as good as anyone else that my family who made it in New Jersey. And I think I read a study recently where somebody actually tried to put that myth to bed. So they did this double blind taste test with like everything from regular tap water to filtered water to distilled water to like Perrier, like mineral water at the high end. And the only way that they started seeing a difference was when it was like some sort of mineral water that had an ultra high mineral content. It would kind of retard certain processes in the dough, but for the most part, nobody could tell the difference at all. And so it had no difference on impact.
We can make just as good pizza here in Wisconsin without trucking in cartons and cartons of New York municipal water.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about some more great summertime topping combinations. I watch my CSA coming in. People are going to farmers markets. What kind of things have you excited about putting on a pizza this time of year?
Well, one of the most fun things about pizza is that really it can be kind of the vessel for all of your CSA toppings. All of your CSA vegetables. Everything from right now, tomatoes are going to start coming. We're getting them from greenhouses at the farmer's market, and that usually makes me excited because tomatoes are basically fresh tomatoes are one of my favorite toppings to put on pizza. Summer squash is excellent, and you can pair that with things like goat cheese. Basically, any dish that you're inspired from, any summer dish that you're inspired by can basically be translated to the pizza. Just always think of the pizza as the plate, rutabaga pizzas are not very popular when we make them, although I've always felt that it would be nice because we have so many root vegetables in the wintertime that I wish we can kind of get that whole rutabaga pizza thing going. But tomatoes, fresh cheeses from the market. There's just so many things that you can do. Peas, English peas are going to be around real soon. That's another favorite thing to put on pizza with some sort of salty meat, whether it's like guanciale or bacon, and those sweet English peas that are those shelled peas. They make an awesome pizza topping. The only limit is really someone's imagination.
You mentioned summer squash, and it's an eternal quest in Wisconsin to figure out what to do with all the zucchini that you grew or your neighbor's trying to dump off on you. I would worry that when you work with zucchini a lot, you realize it's like 98% water or something like that. I would worry about it getting the pizza soggy. Do we need to do anything special with that?
Not really, no. And the heat in the grill is, that high heat is going to kind of evaporate, wick some of that moisture away too. So if you're grilling those pizzas outside, that's gonna help quite a bit. But really, summer squash and zucchini, I don't think that they're too watery for pizza, but a lot of things, you could pre-roast the squash, which is one of the things that I like to do. Roast that squash on the grill, get it nice and smoky, puree it, and then make that squash the sauce.
So. Patrick DePula is with us, chef and owner of Salvatore's Tomato Pies in Madison. It's Food Friday. He's talking to us today about cooking pizza on the grill and great things to do with pizza on the grill or in the oven. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever grilled pizzas? How'd it go? Do you have a favorite way to make pizza at home? What is your favorite combination of toppings on your pizza, whether you make it in the oven or on the grill? Do you have a question for our guest about how to fix problems maybe with your home pizza experiments? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. By the way, head over to WPR.org/Food Friday. Find that recipe from Patrick for roasted beet pesto grilled pizza. Stick around. More to come on Food Friday on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our Food Friday conversation with Chef Patrick DePula, with us today to talk about cooking pizzas on the grill. Patrick's the chef and owner at Salvatore's Tomato Pies in Madison. He's also got a pizza place in Sun Prairie, I should mention. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you, have you now, or have you planned to grill pizzas? Are you going to do it this summer? How has it gone for you? Do you have a favorite way to make pizzas, on the grill or in the oven? Favorite topping combos, or a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Drew is with us in Fitchburg. Drew, hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Drew?
Well, I had a favorite combination of toppings, and that is fig and prosciutto. And I had that at a restaurant in Cincinnati. It was a wood-fired grill. I just got my first grill and a pizza stone, so I'm hoping to try to recreate it. My question is, what is the best prosciutto to use when grilling pizza?
Ooh. Any thoughts?
Yeah, you know, prosciutto di Parma is obviously the gold standard when it comes to prosciutto. You can get that at any of the number of Italian delis in Madison. I think both of the major ones stock prosciutto di Parma. It's the highest quality. It's somewhere around $18 a pound-ish. And, you know, a little bit goes a long way, too. You want to slice it thin and then just put it on at the end after the pizza is done baking.
Drew, thanks a lot. Good luck. Stop by with that pizza when you've made it. Patrick, that general combination, the something salty like that prosciutto, something sweet like the figs, is that a good theory to work with?
Yeah, I mean, one of the pizzas that we're known for is we do a fig and bacon pizza, and that fig and bacon pizza in the Madison restaurant is pretty popular, and there's another play on it with the prosciutto and fig and pistachios in Sun Prairie, so it's kind of a classic. You'll find that a lot of places.
And figs, just dried figs, and you dice them up,
fresh? We use dried. It's just sort of impractical to get to get fresh figs.
Stop by the fig farm at the farmer's market. Yeah, yep. We don't really have that so much.
No.
Drew, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to Victor with us in Freedom. Victor, hi. Do we have Victor? Victor's gone. Okay, Victor, let's see, suggests grilling pizzas while camping. Oh, and buy a small flour tortilla. Let's see. He just uses tortillas to grill and camping. That's a quick, easy to transport, it sounds like.
That's an awesome idea for camping. You know, it'll probably be easy to transport and really quick to make.
Any thoughts on grilling over or making pizza over a campfire? I guess with the right a rack or something like that, it wouldn't be too hard.
Yeah, I'm going to channel the Boy Scout in me right now.
Okay.
You know, I'm a volunteer leader with my kids' scout troop, too. So pizza is something that we talked about, and you can do it. As long as you bring the proper, like I would bring a cast iron pan and do it in the cast iron pan, or maybe even a Dutch oven while camping. You get more of like a thicker crust in that Dutch oven, so it might be a little more like Chicago style pizza.
So I imagine all the kids are saying, "Yeah, so you're coming right to the camp out this weekend. You're bringing all your pizza fixings, right?"
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That's got to be a popular thing. Mm. Thanks a lot. We'll go now to Gary. Gary, hi. You're on the air.
Yes. I'd like to know where you can get some good acid tomatoes like we used to get years ago. Does anybody have them, or where can you get them, or whatever? These tomatoes nowadays are all tasting like store-bought stuff.
Gotcha. That's an interesting question. I love heirloom tomatoes, and there's plenty of farms in the area, like at the Dane County Farmers Market, or that you'll find on the Monona Farmers Market, the Northside Farmers Market, what have you. When tomato season starts, look for the heirlooms, and you're going to find that flavor that you're looking for, that flavor that's not really been bred to, you know, be super shelf stable or manipulated by people. Those heirloom varieties are awesome, and we use a lot of them.
Thanks a lot. Good luck finding those heirlooms at your local farmer's market. Patrick DePula is with us for Food Friday. He's chef and owner of Salvatore's Tomato Pies, and he is helping us grill and otherwise prepare great pizzas. You can find one of his recipes, by the way, at WPR.org/Food Friday. It is a roasted beet pesto grilled pizza. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. We've got Anne with us in Green Bay. Anne, hello.
Hello. There's a place in Appleton called the Green Gecko, and they make a pizza called Donald Blue. And it's made with duck meat, like duck, D-U-C-K, like as in Donald Duck, and blue cheese. And I don't know what else all they put on it, but I'll tell you, the combination is just really interesting.
And it sounds really rich to me. Is it kind of heavy duty?
It is, but it's really good. I mean, the first bite, you kind of think, I don't know if I like this. But after a couple more bites, like, oh, this was really good.
So. And thanks. Duck on pizza.
Yeah, duck's a great pizza topping. In season, in the wintertime, duck confit, you know, we use a lot. Other restaurants use it a lot on pizza, too. You know, duck confit with some sort of fruit, whether it's Door County cherry, so you get that little bit of, like, acidicness in there, and then some sort of smoky blue cheese. You know, all those things go really, really well together.
Well, that makes me think now, Patrick, you mentioned that the rutabaga pizza isn't necessarily big with people. You can get creative with pizza, but have you hit points where people are like, man, you've gone too far this time?
Yes, we did a pizza with sushi rolls on it once.
What's wrong with that?
Maggi rolls.
Uh-huh.
It looked interesting and didn't really go over so well. We also did a pizza with a black pizza with squid ink in the pizza dough. So the pizza's black, and we used octopus, and there were some other things on it. We also did, around Halloween one year, we did a pizza with fried grasshoppers and some other things that really, I think we sold like three. Some of those things don't go over well, but it's fun to do them.
And we did a show. We actually did a segment on cooking with insects, where you were able to source food-grade grasshoppers,
yep.
I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Was it good? Did
yep.
you like it?
Yep. And I think, where did I get those? I think I got them at, there was just a, like, some sort of place that sold beef jerky also sold those bugs.
Two yes. great tastes.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right, back to your calls now. Mitch is with us in Green Bay. Mitch, hi.
Hi there. Big fan. I live in Madison, just up the street from the one on East Johnson, but currently in Green Bay. I just wanted to ask about all-purpose versus bread flour. Do you use a combination or just one or the other for homemade? And also, what kind of yeast do you recommend using when making dough at home? Thanks.
Sure. I mean, you could go a lot of ways. I would use bread flour at home. You know, in the restaurant, we use a mixture of we use flour from Lonesome Stone Milling that's out in Lone Rock. And so that's Wisconsin-grown wheat, and it's whole wheat. And we mix that with unbleached, unbromated white flour, which is bread flour. Bread flour works really well at home because most of the time, I mean, you don't really need all that super high gluten for the pizza that you're making at home in your home oven or on the grill. But I think bread flour does a really nice job, especially if you let that sit overnight. And, you know, it's just one of those that you can even add whole wheat to it and, you know, experiment with other grains for that matter. But I think bread flour works really well for home pizza making.
Now let's talk about wheat flour. I think I've had pizza possibly in a predecessor at the same location you're in now, which maybe was too much wheat flour. Sometimes it ends up getting a little dry.
Oh, yeah.
if you don't eat it right away. Mm-hmm. So you have to mix it up a little bit.
Yeah. It took us quite a long time to try and get that balance just right. So, you know, you're getting the flavor of that the wheat and the bran that's unbroken. So the bran is intact and those oils are intact in the flour. So you're getting that sweetness that's natural without having to put sugar in the dough. And the fermentation process helps too. So we don't use any sugar or anything like that. We let the dough process itself naturally and develop that sweetness. But that whole wheat flour really helps do that. It gives it that sweet, nutty flavor.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. I know some people are probably out there asking for gluten-free. Do you have thoughts on making a good gluten-free crust?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's one of those things that we've experimented with, but I can't really do it in my restaurants because there's so much flour in the air mm-hmm. that we can't make them from scratch. It would just be too risky to contaminate. So what we do is there's a gluten-free bake shop in Milwaukee that we purchase our gluten-free crust from. So they're certified, and it makes it much easier for us to be able to offer those because they come sealed. But it's a really good – I know that the ingredients in it that kind of gives it a little bit of that chew is the potato flour. So there's potato flour and tapioca flour that seem to replicate regular pizza as much as possible. So it's a little crunchy and it's a little chewy at the same time. So I tend to go for gluten-free crusts that have those ingredients in them.
We got an email from Ann in Madison. Ann says, I also believe anything can be made into pizza and is better for it. It's a little early for fresh, Ann says, but corn is excellent on a pizza and pairs pretty much with any sauce, tomato, barbecue, white, whatever.
Ann is absolutely 100% correct. Corn is super awesome for pizza, especially like in season when we'll like roast that with some chili peppers and some other things, and maybe there's a little bit of smoked paprika in it, what have you. It just makes an awesome, hearty kind of relish for pizza or almost anything.
Maybe roasted winter squash with that. Sounds like it'd be pretty good.
Absolutely. And, you know, corn may not be in season, but Awesome Sweet Corn is one of the vendors at the farmer's market. They still have frozen corn available too. So, you know, you can still get it and it's still local.
Is there a seasonal vegetable or whatever produce that you just spend the rest of the year kind of looking forward to when that hits the market?
Tomatoes.
It's tomatoes.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Tomato season happens. It's we go to the farmer's market every Saturday morning. So the soon as people start having, you know, soil grown heirloom tomatoes, that's like when I can't get enough of them. And they go on everything on our menu. And it's just kind of ridiculous. From burrata to the pizza to every other dish that we've got, I'm trying to incorporate tomatoes for the short period of time that we have them.
Now, for tomato as a topping, as opposed to making sauce with it,
mm-hmm.
does this bake the whole time, or is this like a put-on at the end of the story?
No, it bakes the whole time.
Okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And any favorite heirlooms that you say people should watch out for Ooh. When they're making pizza?
One of my favorites always are like the what are they? The black crims, the black cherry tomatoes.
I don't think I've even seen that.
They're super delicious. The just the yellow tomatoes are awesome.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to not want to eat all of them at the market. So,
Patrick, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That's Patrick DePula. He's chef and owner of Salvatore's Tomato Pies in Madison. He joins today to talk about making pizzas on the grill and some advice for great toppings and crust on or off the grill. You can find one of his recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. That is the roasted beet pesto grilled pizza. Give it a try this weekend. President Trump is blaming Iran for yesterday's attack on two oil tankers near the Persian Gulf. The Norwegian and Japanese tankers reported explosions in the Gulf of Oman and burst into flames. Everyone on board was rescued by the U.S. or Iranian navies. In a briefing yesterday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo accused Iran of lashing out against U.S. sanctions, but didn't offer proof. However, last night, the U.S. military released video of what it says are Iranian forces removing an unexploded mine from one of the tankers. President Trump weighed in on Fox News this morning.
Well, Iran did do it, and you know they did it because you saw the boat. I guess one of the mines didn't explode, and it's probably got essentially Iran written all over it. And you saw the boat at night trying to take the mine off and successfully took the mine off the boat.
Yep.
And that was exposed, and that was their boat, that was them. And they didn't want the evidence left behind. I guess they don't know that we have things that we can detect mm-hmm. in the dark that work very well.
Iran has denied any involvement and says the U.S. may have carried out the attack in an effort to blame it on them. Robbie Grammer is a diplomacy and national security reporter at Foreign Policy Magazine, where he covers the State Department. Robbie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you talk about these attacks and the importance of the Gulf of Oman and the oil tankers that go through it?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the Gulf of Oman is near the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf, and it's a strategic choke point through which about a third of the world's oil transits go through. So it's definitely a very important transit route, and this incident has definitely escalated tensions between the United States and Iran at a point where the relations between the two countries aren't exactly great.
What do we know about evidence pointing toward Iran being behind these attacks, as we're hearing from the White House?
Well, as you said, Secretary Pompeo and the Trump administration have already blamed Iran, and the United Kingdom has just come out and also backed up the U.S. claims. But there are still a lot of questions swirling around what exactly happened. The U.S. Central Command released video footage purportedly showing Iranians removing a unexploded mine from one of the vessels, but the Japanese and Norwegian governments haven't yet pinned the blame on Iran. And in addition, the German foreign minister, Heiko Maas, said that video evidence isn't enough now. So I think what we're seeing is a lot of U.S. allies who are really nervous about tensions in the regions and tensions between Washington and Tehran step very carefully around this. And I think they're what they're doing right now, according to analysts and officials we've spoken to, is carefully going through all of the evidence they have, waiting for intelligence assessments to come in before they join the United States in blaming Iran, if they do.
I've heard from some experts on the region that there might be elements within the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Navy who are only sort of directly under control of Iranian authorities, who might lone wolf or sort of do an operation, maybe something like this, without the full approval of the Iranian government. Do you have any thoughts on that possibility?
Yeah, that's definitely a theory that's been floated, and it's definitely a plausible theory. One element that analysts who say this point to is that the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was just in Iran trying to open up a dialogue between the United States and the Iranian government to help ease tensions. And of course, one of the vessels targeted here is a Japanese vessel. And so there are some analysts who are putting forth maybe there are different hardline elements within the regime trying to stoke tensions. But at this point, it's too soon to tell. And the Iranian government, as usual, is remaining tight-lipped, only sticking to the points that, no, it's not responsible. And the Iranian leader has said that he's not willing to engage in dialogue with Trump.
Now, we have these attacks. We had some other explosions on tankers over the last month or so. Some people are pointing back toward the 1980s during the Iran-Iraq war, where both sides would target oil tankers as part of economic warfare against each other. How did the U.S. Intervene in those instances?
Well, in the so-called tanker war in the 80s, what the United States did was deploy some of its naval forces to escort tankers throughout that region. Now, that's something that the Trump administration has floated doing again. But remember, this comes at a time when the administration is really trying to pivot away from the Middle East and focus on confronting China and confronting Russia and other areas of the world. So that would be an open-ended commitment that would require a lot of U.S. military capabilities. And, you know, there are some people here in Washington who question whether that's really worth it.
Talking to Robbie Grammer from Foreign Policy Magazine about Iran, the U.S., and attacks on oil tankers in the Mideast. Robbie, some people have been looking at the 2001 authorization for the use of military force. There's been some rumblings from the White House that could be used as an authorization for military action against Iran. We've seen some people, Democrats in particular in Congress, saying, hold on, no, it doesn't. What is the state of the art on that?
Well, the 2001 AUMF is the legal justification that that successive administrations have used to carry out military operations against terrorist groups in different parts of the world, mostly the Middle East and Afghanistan. And there are a lot in Congress who worry that administrations have abused that and that Congress needs to reassert its role in deciding when and where the United States goes to war. Now, the mostly progressive Democrats are really worried about the administration using this 2001 document as a legal justification for war with Iran. Right now, the administration is sticking to the line that it still wants to engage in diplomacy with Iran. The last thing it wants is war. But just in case, there's a number of Democrats pushing measures through Congress to try to explicitly prevent the 2001 AUMF from being used to go to war with Iran. In the past, all those efforts to try to curtail AUMFs have failed in Congress. And so we'll see where this one goes, but it remains to be seen.
A lot of times it seems like the authorization for use of military force of 2001 has cited some kind of al-Qaeda or its successor group, in some ways, ISIS activity in whatever the country is involved. Is that case being made in Iran that somehow it has supported or worked with al-Qaeda or ISIS?
Not yet. However, interestingly, Secretary Pompeo yesterday went through a laundry list of some attacks that he says the Iranian regime is responsible for. And one of the ones he listed was an attack in Afghanistan that killed several people in recent months that the Taliban already claimed credit for. So based off of that, you can infer that the administration is linking Iran to the activity of the Taliban in Afghanistan, which has some analysts and experts raising their eyebrows and casting doubt on those claims. So they haven't explicitly drawn the connection between Iran and ISIS or al-Qaeda yet. Obviously, Iran is Shia majority country, and these terrorist groups are Sunni based. So some analysts really question that, but the administration so far has withheld directly connecting these incidents.
There are some indications that neither Iran nor the United States actually want a war. But even if that's true, is there a concern that we could see a chain of events that leads the countries stumbling into war?
Absolutely. And I think that's where a lot of the Democrats are making their arguments and putting forth these measures in Congress now to try to limit the administration's ability to go to war with Iran without prior congressional approval. I mean, the president himself has shown he has no appetite for war with Iran. Secretary Pompeo was pretty sharp in condemning Iran yesterday, but still left the avenue open for diplomacy. But the Trump administration has really cracked down on Iran with sanctions, with withdrawing from the Iranian nuclear deal. And a lot of European allies are worried that the United States right now is backing Iran into a corner. And there might be, you know, an incident, a flare-up, such as the incident we saw in the Gulf of Oman, that could spiral and escalate into a further and full-fledged conflict.
Saudi Arabia and Israel, in some cases, have been cooperating to try to contain what they see as a threat from Iran. Have we heard from either of those countries about these incidents, these attacks on tankers?
Well, what's interesting is obviously Saudi Arabia and Iran and Israel have always criticized Iran for its activities in the region, but some of the United States allies in the region have yet to explicitly blame Iran for these attacks. Like I said earlier, they're still waiting for this information to trickle in. So the United Arab Emirates, which is located close to the Gulf of Oman, has criticized Iran's response to the purported attacks, but has yet to explicitly blame Iran. And so I think we're still in a wait-and-see mode with a lot of U.S. allies.
As we wrap up, Robbie, what are you watching for next in this story?
I think you need to watch for an Iranian response. I think you need to watch what U.S. allies do. If they back up the U.S. claims that Iran is responsible. And additionally, the United States has poured a lot of military equipment and diplomatic effort into deterring Iran. So if we see small-scale events like this in the near future, other oil tankers being targeted, you could definitely see another escalation in tensions and new fears of a conflict between the U.S. and Iran.
Robbie, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Robbie Grammer, diplomacy and national security reporter at Foreign Policy Magazine, where he covers the State Department. We talked with him about yesterday's attack on two oil tankers near the Persian Gulf. The Trump administration is blaming Iran. Iran is denying responsibility. A new report in The Guardian highlights the troubles facing small-town radio stations around the country and what they mean for the communities they serve. Says there are two big factors at play, a lack of advertising dollars and big media companies with deep pockets. So a lot of stations are going away, along with the information that people tend not to get from other sources. And losing those stations can take away part of a community's identity. Dennis Denninger is a communications professor at Syracuse University and former longtime executive at ESPN. His first media job was at a small AM radio station in Hornell, New York. Dennis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, take us back to that first media job at a small station in New York. What was that station like?
Well, it was a 1 kilowatt daytimer, which meant that in the wintertime, you went off the air at 4:30 because you had to go off at sunset to make room for the higher power stations that would come on in larger communities around. And I started working there when I was a senior in high school. I would walk in and walk to the radio station and gather the morning news. I would check with the local police, check to see what was going on, make some phone calls, and then put together some newscasts with couple that with what I got on the UPI teletype. And I did the news until about 8:30 in the morning, and then I walked to school.
Is that station still around?
Yes, they are. I don't live in that area. However, they do some local programming, but most of their programming they get from other places.
Now, talk about the role of these small stations, whether they run all day or not, for small rural communities. What kind of function do they play there?
Well, as with any part of the media, they have this role of providing you with information. And what are your neighbors doing? What is affecting the schools that your kids go to? Did the teacher that you had 20 years ago just pass away? We used to actually do obituaries that we read on the radio station so that people would know who had passed away and when calling hours were, et cetera, et cetera. But you know what? It's also providing people with the kind of entertainment that they've gotten used to and with information about government services that are available to people and what your local retailers are doing. Advertising is a really important part of information for how do we get the stuff that we need to do the things we do.
We've heard a lot about the decline of local newspapers and consolidation in that industry. What have been the trends when it comes to radio stations, especially in smaller towns?
Well, a huge turning point was in 1996. The Telecommunications Act virtually eliminated the old FCC rules as to how many stations an individual company, any company could own. Back before 1996, nobody could own more than 40 radio stations across the United States. And now iHeart has 850 radio stations in 150 different radio markets. And Cumulus, for example, has 441 stations in 90 markets. And what they do is they set up remote service agreements in that you could be getting your information piped in, your programming piped in from Albany, and you got a little station in Hornell or your little station in Skaneateles, New York, or any of these little places. And you're not going to get any local news virtually. You're going to get all of it just entertainment and music programming fed in from another city. And that cuts down on what you know about where you live.
I understand also that in some cases, if you're in a small town near a big market, well, one of those, the Clear Channel or iHeartRadio, might be really interested in your frequency, buying it out so they can use it in that bigger market. Is that something that's happening?
That happens a lot. That happens a lot. And because if you can reach people in a larger metro area with a little station, I teach at Syracuse, and say you can buy up a little station in Oswego, New York, or something that is still can be heard in Syracuse. Well, you can get that license. You can buy that station for a lower price and then start selling advertising to the people in Syracuse, the retailers, the advertisers in Syracuse. And what does that do? That drives rates up and puts the local folks who would want to share their information with you. It prevents them from having a voice.
Talking to Dennis Denninger, communications professor at Syracuse University, about the decline of smaller town and rural radio stations around the country and the gaps that leaves behind. Dennis, is there anything you see at the local level starting to fill the void left by these radio stations and also by local newspapers?
Well, you know, there are community forums, there are services that are available online, and you can, there are a variety of these different little news services, but they're in the menu of all of the rest of the services that you can get online. And if you're going to the menu and you would prefer to watch YouTube videos that will crack you up and that you'll enjoy, well, then, you know, maybe you select that 9 out of 10 times from the menu that also has the community news. So I don't know, it lumps everything together, and the more that it's part of this mass media big tech menu, the less there is of a local presence. And that really results in a cultural and informational deficit for a lot of people.
Do you see a need for changes in regulation or telecommunications laws and so forth that might create more of an open door for these kind of services?
Well, it's interesting. The House Judiciary Committee just this week started some hearings on the influence of big tech in the media. And there's a bill that's being proposed called the Journalism Competition and Preservation Act. It's being sponsored in the House by a Republican and a Democratic sponsor. And the idea there is to give publishers an antitrust exemption so that they could work together the way that big tech works together to provide you Facebook in communities all around the world or any of the other services, Google and all the rest. And those companies are making huge dollars off of the services that used to be provided by locals. And they're also selling advertising in local news, which means advertising dollars are going away from the local publishers. So that's specifically targeted at publishers. But I would not be surprised that if after the hearings are completed, that there is some kind of consideration given to broadcast as well, because these little radio stations are just, you know, they're going out of business. And the interesting thing, Rob, is that people haven't stopped listening to the radio, whereby a lot of people have stopped getting a local newspaper. They've stopped reading newspapers. They'll go online for their information. But the Nielsen total audience report that they do quarterly, the most recent one shows that 92% of American adults who are 18 or over are listening to radio during the week, and they're averaging an hour and 45 minutes a day, which is on the way to work, which is listening at work. But if what you're listening to is devoid of local information, then you're missing out.
Do you see exceptions? Do you see better cases where a small town radio station has managed to hang on and maybe thrive despite all the headwinds you've described?
Yes. You know, there are stations that become part of the fabric of a community, and through the force of their context, their connections with the local businesses over a period of years, through the force of dynamic personalities, those kinds of things help drive success greater than other places that have more of a turnover, that have new businesses coming in with different ways of marketing their products that don't include local radio. So there are success stories. I'm not foolish enough to think that things are going to go back in time, but if there was an opportunity for the encouragement of greater local ownership as opposed to mass ownership, where there are basically about 10 firms that control over 90% of the radio broadcast media in the United States. And, you know, are you confident that those people, wherever they're headquartered, have your best interest at heart?
Very briefly, Dennis, we see declining trust in media. Do you think people would trust the media more if it was not just, you know, somebody in New York, but Dennis, the high school kid down the street on the air?
Yeah, you know, because there's accountability there, and you're present in the community, and there's a way to contact you. Sadly, a lot of our life has become connected to distant networks. You use your smartphone to connect with all around the world, but you might bump into somebody that if you looked up and chatted with them, you might learn something.
We'll leave it there. Dennis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
A pleasure.
That's Dennis Denninger, communications professor at Syracuse University. He worked at a small AM radio station in New York State early in his media career. We talked to him about a decline in the number of rural radio stations in the United States and the information and community gap that can be left when those stations shut down. If you want to give a shout out to your local rural station, tweet us at Central Time WPR. What is your favorite vegetable? The produce company Green Giant asked 5,000 Americans that question in a survey. The results are in just in time for National Eat Your Vegetables Day, which apparently is this coming Monday. I don't know why. The company released a map showing the winning vegetables state by state. The most common winter in states around the country is broccoli, winning in 39 states. I kind of question that result. I like broccoli, fine. Don't get me wrong. I cook with it pretty often. But really, that many people pick it as their number one favorite vegetable? Now, here in Wisconsin, though, we chose a different path. The number one vegetable in Wisconsin, according to this survey, is corn. I have another problem here. I like corn a lot, on or off the cob, even on pizza, as we heard earlier. But nutritionally, not a vegetable. On my plate, it's the carb. You invite me to dinner, you ask me to bring vegetable, I'm not showing up with corn. Same goes for potatoes, by the way. Love them. Not a vegetable in the nutrition department. I have been subjected to mockery and derision by friends and family for my bold stance on this issue. Where was I? Oh yeah, carrots. Now that's a vegetable. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.